Welcome to Gaia's Unexplained Podcast. Go beyond the mainstream to uncover hidden truths and decode ancient origins. If you want to go deeper, visit Gaia.com. Watch interviews, movies, and original series created to empower a community of fellow seekers. For more information, visit GaiaUnexplained.com.
Welcome to Beyond Belief. We've got a great guest for you, Matthew LaCroix, an author and researcher. And while attending college, he began studying archaeology, history, philosophy, and quantum mechanics. Matthew, welcome to Beyond Belief. Great to have you.
Thanks, George. It's great to be here.
By the way, I'm still getting response from the radio show you did with us 4 years ago.
Yeah, I really enjoyed those coast-to-coast shows with you, and that's why I've been so looking forward to sitting down to talk to you again.
How did you get involved in ancient archaeology and civilizations?
Well, it really wasn't a path that I planned for. It was something that sort of fell right into my lap.
Aha.
By accident, and it was one of those things that a lot of people talk about being a rabbit hole where you sort of glimpse into it a little bit, and then
and
you
it
want
gets
you have
deeper
more,
and deeper.
Yeah,
and deeper.
Exactly. And you just keep wanting to ask more and more questions, and then before you know it, you're all the way down, and you're looking at things in a completely different way, and you're trying to understand all these mysteries of the past.
These past civilizations are fascinating to investigate, aren't they?
Yeah, it captivates my imagination. Try to understand something, a culture that's completely gone and vanished, to try to imagine how sophisticated they could have been, especially based on the evidence we're looking at, we really get a much different picture of those civilizations than just being nomadic hunter-gatherers that then all of a sudden eventually became civilized.
Sure.
It's a very different story.
Matthew, where do you think the cradle of civilization began?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the history books do get that right with being the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, near the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River.
Which is modern-day Iraq, right?
Exactly, right? Which a lot of this instability in those areas preventing a lot of archaeologists from getting to those ancient sites. But I really do think that, as we're going to get in and talk about, we're talking about multiple epics of different groups that have been there rather than just one group.
The epics of Gilgamesh and stuff like that.
Huh? Yeah, and that's one of the great sets of tablets that I love to read and find some of the secrets in there.
The late Zechariah Sitchin was obsessed with the Anunnaki, which he claims came to us from another planet called Nibiru, which is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. It comes and goes. Every time it gets close, there's some kind of major earth change, and then it goes away again. But he claims they came here, seeded us, because they needed workers to pull gold out of the planet. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I want to give Zechariah Sitchin credit for really getting the narrative started. He was the one who brought a lot of these really mysterious texts that a lot of people thought were just poems or parables, and he brought this to life, talking about the Anunnaki,
right,
what their role was with our story and how we came here and how we came about with civilization rising and the influences that they had. And so to me, he was the pioneer behind it, but I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand directly from the tablets, and that was one of the things that one of my major focuses was finding out who translated them most accurately and then really getting in and studying them for years and years and years to really understand what this ancient story was.
So Matthew, let's look at some of these tablets and maybe you can kind of interpret them for us.
Sure.
Here's our first one. What is this?
So the first tablet we're going to be reading is not one that most people are aware of. It was one that I did some digging and actually found. And to me, it connected to so many other tablets
that
I read.
Where did you find it?
This is just one of the ones where the University of Oxford has a great library,
okay,
cataloging a lot of these. So the tablet essentially describes how kingship descended down from heaven, and the first place that kingship was lowered to was Eridu. And then it goes on to talk about how in Eridu, Aluem became the king, and it talks about this extended amount of years that he ruled for. And it goes through and it keeps mentioning how the city would fall and the kingship was taken to another city. And then it goes on and on and on. But the part that I also particularly want to point out is at the end. When it mentions here, it says at the end, then Sippar fell, and the kingship was taken to Shurupak. And if you see right below Shurupak, it says, then the flood swept over, giving us, George, a way to try to measure when this event occurred. Because if we're able to understand when that flood was...
Is this the flood of Noah?
That's right. This is the flood which I've traced back to really looking at things like ice core samples, geology and all these different pieces of evidence to what's known as the Younger Dryas cataclysms, which is around between 12,800 years ago and about 11,000 years ago.
Now, they talk about the king ruling for 28,000 years, a king ruling for 36,000 years. How can that be?
It's so mysterious, isn't it, George? And one of the things that is the challenge behind this was that they didn't actually catalog these or record them in years. They recorded them was known as shars. And so the shars represented a certain amount of time, and interpreting that amount of time has been difficult.
Who do you think the authors were of those tablets?
Well, that's a good question, because one of the things you find that when you look at the Sumerians, the ancient Sumerians of Mesopotamia, and then you look at later cultures like the Akkadians and the Babylonians, you find versions of those tablets that were rewritten and translated in the later groups, but they all translate from the ancient Sumerian stories originally.
Let's look at our second tablet and tell us what this is. This is fascinating. What are we looking at here, Matt?
So here we go. We have another one of these tablets that really brings the same types of information we find for the previous tablet in here. And this tablet is known as the Eridugenesis. And I want to point out that notice the same type of language that's used, George. We see this royal scepter from heaven, the same thing as kingship. Just another way of saying kingship.
Yeah.
When it was lowered from heaven, it talks about how it was brought down and the first city was created. And as it says, just like the other tablet, Eridu was the first city created. So it mimics, the tablets mimic each other with the same information. Now the name over there, Nutamid, is actually another name for Enki, meaning that the first city ever created
of that name, sure,
was basically given to this leader, Enki. And that provides us with a background to try to understand when these cities existed, who ruled in those cities, and what the influences were of those.
Where is modern-day Eridu now, do you think?
So that's a great question. One of the areas that I've really studied is trying to figure that out, right? Where is Eridu?
Where are these places? Yeah.
If it's the first city ever created for civilization and it's carried over by tablet after tablet, to me, it would be one of the most important ancient sites in the world.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the things you find,
George, there should be some remnants of this.
That's right. And one of the things that you'll find is that there was an archaeological dig that was done in the 1940s by the University of Oxford. And they went out into Iraq, near the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, and they found the ancient ruins of Eridu sitting out in the desert. And if you go and you look into images, which we're going to be showing one of those coming up, you see this giant area of disturbed ground in the middle of the desert, and there's nothing around it guarding it. There's no fences. There's no tourism. There's no archaeologists doing digs.
It's just there.
They went out in the University of Oxford in the 1940s, went out, identified where the site was, walked around, took pictures, and as far as I know, never returned.
What do you mean never returned?
That's the ultimate question. If you have something like this that's so fundamentally important, well, how could something like that just slip through the cracks and disappear? And to this day, it's sitting in the middle of the desert without any kind of archaeological study being done on it, and it's largely being ignored by modern academics.
If you had to guess the complexity of the space, how big is it?
It's enormous. It contains its own ziggurat, as well as other remnants of temples and many, many other structures, but it's so ancient that all we have left are largely sand that's blown in over it and buried it underneath layers and layers of debris and sediment.
Matthew, when they found the Sphinx in Egypt, it was up to sand, was up to its eyes practically, you know, just the little top of it was sticking out. Would that be the same thing as this city, Eridu?
That's right. It seems like rather than history all falling into this 6,000-year window, things are much older than modern academia wants to give credit for. And so what we find is that different time periods of cultures that came and went, and then other civilizations found their remnants, their ruins, and either built on top of it, or it just remained in the desert and sand blew in until it was almost covered up.
Why aren't they digging it out?
Well, that's that question that takes you down that rabbit hole of, just like we mentioned with Eridu, this amazingly important ancient site sitting there in a war-torn region that is being ignored and not even being uncovered. It really begs the question of, is this just disrupting the narrative that's been established for civilizations and human history? And perhaps those things that don't fit in, that those pieces of archaeology that don't fit that narrative, are just quietly being pushed to the side.
Are there any megalithic structures there?
There is. There's actually one in Iraq. And the reason why I don't think there's more megalithic structures there is the type of geology. But there is one. It's known as Kinnis Rock. And it's actually just a little bit north of Nineveh, near the ancient aqueducts of Jerwan. And there is, in Nineveh, there's a place called Kinnis Rock. And it's this massive rock relief on a vertical plane. And it basically has the Assyrian versions of the Sumerian gods of Enlil and his consort, and there, and her, his name in that is Assur, and he's up on this massive rock relief, basically passing knowledge to these other civilizations. And it's so ancient, though, George, that a lot of it is broken away, and there's only pieces of it that remain. But just like Eridu nearby, it's not being studied at all. It's just sitting there, largely ignored today.
Are there structures, megalithic structures, all over the planet, Matthew?
There is, and some of them are much more sophisticated than others. But in what we really do find is that when we can trace the type of building practices, no mortar, no brick and mortar, but using straight giant megalithic rocks and basically carving them with such precision that you can't even fit a human hair or a piece of paper through them.
Right.
When we can identify that type of stone masonry, we know that that's one of what I call the lost civilizations. Those ancient cultures that had advanced building practices and knowledge and even tools that became wiped out and disappeared, and then cultures came later.
Just gone, like the pyramids.
That's right, and they tried to mimic them, but they weren't able to.
How would you compare some of these structures to modern-day buildings today?
I think that we're still trying to catch up with what they knew.
Wow.
I know, and that seems hard for some people to wrap their heads around, but if you go to a place like the Valley Temple of Egypt, or you go across the world or into Peru and you go to Ollantaytambo or Sacsayhuaman, or you look at any of those areas, Machu Picchu, where some of the older structures are, some of the precision that's with those stone masonry is, from a lot of the experts that have gone to look at it, even beyond our capability today.
On the Gaia Show, Ancient Civilizations, Andrew Collins talks about Baalbek in Lebanon. It's an amazing structure, as you well know.
Baalbek is one of the big enigmas of which there is very little answers. We're talking about a huge complex that was constructed during Roman times, a massive temple dedicated to the god Jupiter. Amongst the foundations of this incredible complex are stone blocks weighing around 1,000 tons apiece. But the big question comes, did they reuse those stones, those big ones, the 1,000 tonners? That's the thing. And if they did reuse them, who the hell created those stones in the first place, and why so large?
That's incredible what he just said, Matthew. What do you think?
To me, when I've studied the megalithic ruins around the world, like we mentioned, not just being something like Stonehenge, but more of using massive blocks to connect together to create some kind of an incredible structure, what you find is that Baalbek was where they perfected their megalithic tool design to create these blocks. Andrew Collins did a great job showing some of those huge blocks on some of the lower parts.
How did they move them?
Absolutely amazing. We don't really know, but I will tell you, George, that the one block that's shown there is the largest single block in the world. It's called the Trilithon, and it weighs 1,100 tons.
We have machinery today that can't move that.
Isn't that amazing to try to... And they've actually had construction workers look at some of those enormous blocks to try to understand. And our largest cranes today would have difficulty, if not even be able to move some of those blocks.
What do you think happened, Matthew, with the knowledge that simply disappeared? I mean, they had a civilization.
Yeah.
Obviously, they made these structures. We don't know how. But where'd the information go from that point to where we are today? It's gone.
Yeah, so what we find when we look at a combination of ancient writings and geologic evidence and ice core samples, we really find that there have been cyclical series of cataclysms, these disasters that have happened on the earth. And it seems like the ancient cultures knew about them, though. And they created temples to try to map the heavens, to try to understand when they would happen. But when you look at an example like Baalbek, there's actually a quarry near Baalbek where they were quarrying those enormous stones. And when you find is that the largest stones were actually not even taken out of the ground yet. They were in the middle of working on them. And what you find
is... They're still there.
Yeah, they're still there, and they never got a chance to take them out of the grounds, which means that instead of their culture having some kind of a slow downfall, it was a rapid end to their culture.
It was abrupt. It just
exactly,
ended.
And all the work stopped out of nowhere, just like we find in Aswan, Egypt, with the giant obelisk and a lot of the other structures around the world. These cultures had a very rapid end to their building, and they largely disappeared after that.
And this disappear, could it have been in a craft and off they went?
The disappearance of the technologies and the wisdom that they had, we don't really know where it went.
Could it be ET information?
Well, that's the thing is, we're not really sure where it came from, and we can try to perhaps connect the Anunnaki for being perhaps these wisdom bringers that provided some of this knowledge, but we don't truly understand. But one of the peculiar things that a great researcher, Brian Forrester, I'm sure you're aware of.
Good guy.
Yeah, absolutely. He's one of my favorites. He points out that we don't find any tools anywhere in the world.
Nowhere.
Not one.
Nowhere.
Exactly. So where did they go? And that's one of the bizarre things about this is that if whoever built those left, it would make sense that the tools they had, they took with them.
Right. I mean, that's the only explanation. It's not like they buried them, did they? In the Hall of Records somewhere?
Well, if they buried them, we would have found something by now.
So they're all gone.
That's right. And those cultures that came after them tried to mimic them in many ways. Machu Picchu is actually a great example for those who want to go look at those and check out images or visit the site. But you find those incredibly precise blocks on the lower levels. And on the top, what we think of as the Inca, you find more primitive brick and mortar where they were trying to mimic them, but they had nowhere near the knowledge that those previous cultures
did. So on one hand, Matthew, it's exciting, but it's also frustrating, isn't it?
It is, because there's such a lack of coordination with the academic world to get in there and actually study these. And so it's left to individuals that are just doing this because it's a passion thing for them, because they want to.
They love this.
Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah, we truly love this because it's uncovering the truth of the past that has been buried and remains a mystery to most of society.
I'm going to ask you to speculate.
Sure.
What do you think happened to these civilizations?
There's been two camps, I think, on this side of looking at it. One camp looks at this as some kind of an ancient cataclysm from a series of comets or asteroids. And then the other camp, individuals like Robert Schock, look at this from some kind of a solar event, some kind of a corona mass ejection or a solar outburst.
It still doesn't explain how the tools have disappeared.
That's right. It doesn't.
That.
But the only thing that is interesting, though, George, is when you read some of those tablets, it mentions how the Anunnaki actually created that event to occur on Earth, that deluge, that destructive event. And they mention how they left. It actually states in there that they left here during that event. So maybe they brought those tools back with them.
In a craft somewhere.
We don't know. That's actually one of the most...
When you say left, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's so peculiar, George, because all around the world, Saudi Arabia, all the way down through South America, we find these giant doorways, these gateways to the gods, where it just seems to go nowhere. It's just a giant stone doorway, either in a
rock
cliff.
Like a portal's behind it or something?
That's right. It seems like there was technology that once existed.
Whoa.
That no longer is around anymore. And all those technologies that they had to utilize those things are gone. And now we just look at some kind of a rock structure and it doesn't really make any sense to us.
They open this portal, in they go, and they're gone.
From as much as that I've studied this, really looking at the Anunnaki and these ancient influences of them, it seems like the doorway theory of being able to travel somewhere makes more sense to me than a craft.
David Politis, in his book Missing 411, talks about how people simply vanish in state parks.
Yeah.
They're just gone. And it could be very well the same possibility that they're stumbling into some other portal or dimension that you can't see, and they never can come back.
That's a great point. I don't think we fully understand, even though we think we're so advanced in our modern society today, I think there's a lot of the nature of reality and understanding these types of ancient mysteries that we just don't understand today.
Do you think a catastrophe occurred primarily,
Or a series of catastrophes, actually, George.
Okay.
Seems like maybe there would have been several in a row, because when I study these tablets and how they state that these different epics occurred with these kingships in these different cities, I've actually separated into three different time periods, meaning that there were likely two, potentially three, of these events.
Could they happen again, catastrophes?
Well, that's the big question, right? If you look at this and you look at ice core samples from Greenland, you try to get a snapshot for when these types of events occur, it seems like they follow around a 12 to 13,000 year cycle, which if you were to look at when that last occurred, based on what we mentioned during the Younger Dryas, we're right in that time period right now.
Gaia.com lets you explore over 8,000 films, documentaries, and original series.
There's so much going on in the unseen world.
Hidden truth.
Why in the media today? They still seem to hold back on these incredible stories.
Behind an unknown universe.
Where science and spirituality all come together.
Gaia.com. Content you can't find anywhere else. For more information, visit GaiaUnexplained.com.
There are many symbols all around this planet of the ancient worlds. Tell me about that.
Symbols hold, in my opinion, the greatest secrets of all. And it's one of the most difficult things, though, because you have a linear way to look at it, and then you have a symbolic way to look at
right.
it. And so the challenge is to try to blend those to find the truth, because I do think that you have to take both sides of that to understand it. But the ancient cultures were absolutely brilliant. They were able to create a symbol that represented an entire representation of what they were trying to say in one single depiction. And once you understand what those depictions are, you can get a glimpse into what really happened back in long ago.
Give us some examples, Matt, of some of these symbols. What could
yeah,
they
sure.
be?
So if someone was to go to the hospital or they see an ambulance go by, you see that's the rod of Asclepius. The rod with the serpents wound around
right.
it. Right. And then you see the wings of Hermes on the caduceus symbol. These are ancient symbols, but yet today the serpent is considered demonized by a lot of religious groups and
sure.
in modern academia. It doesn't make any sense if it's this symbol that represents health and higher consciousness and ascension.
It's a medical symbol. That's what I think.
That's right. Whereas on the other side, you see symbols like the eagle as well, which I believe have been completely inverted to their opposite representations. The serpent always represented knowledge in reaching higher states of energy and consciousness.
What about the symbols of, like, the pine cone? What does that mean?
Yeah, so the pine cone is another one of these extremely important symbols. Once you start looking at things like the eagle and the serpent, and then you get into things like the pine cone, and what we find, George, is that the pine cone has been shown in these lost civilization locations around the world. We find giant murals with these pine cones being depicted in every one of these
Strange.
Locations nearly around the world, and they're always shown the same way. They hold the pine cone in their hand, and they point it towards someone.
Like it's some object of some kind.
And what I believe based on what I've studied on what that pine cone means is the pine cone represents the passing of knowledge. And so
interesting.
So if you were pointing a pine cone at someone, it would be you providing knowledge. And I mean knowledge of everything. It's not just knowledge of one area. It is the totality of all knowledge.
What about a handbag?
So the handbag is another one of these mysterious symbols that is always present or almost always present with the pine cone. So the way I try to figure things out is, once you know what one symbol is, it'll often have connections to the other. So in this case, the pine cone was the passing of knowledge, and the handbag was being held to their side. That was what this sacred pine cone was supposed to be inside. They're both symbolic, so it would be where you would carry the knowledge. The totality of all knowledge would be the handbag, and then the pine cone would be the passing of knowledge to those civilizations.
Where do you find all these symbols?
You find them all over the world, actually, and if you were to sit down and really study them, and just do like a little search for pinecone and handbag, you'll see that they're depicted in nearly every one of these regions around the world where we find this mysterious evidence of these more advanced buildings and more advanced building practices and more of the types of writings that tend to be much more ancient and go back to the times when we have this information that tells us about those mysteries.
Are these symbols etched on blocks of stone or anything like that?
They're beautifully drawn. Actually, the art in some of these murals and stelas is truly incredible. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about them, George, is you can stare at them for hours because every single little thing that was drawn has some kind of a meaning to it, some kind of a symbolic meaning. And so by understanding what those murals and stelas say, what they're trying to depict, you can, even though you don't have potentially words to go with it, you can understand a story based on just what the depiction is trying to represent.
What would you say, Matthew, in your career is the most bizarre symbol you've come across so far?
The most bizarre symbol, that's a good one. Well, I guess early on, the swastika symbol was always a very strange symbol because I grew up thinking, oh, this is an evil Nazi symbol, you know, all my life,
right.
realizing that the swastika was just an ancient symbol that cultures had all around
the world. The Nazis made it evil.
Exactly.
It wasn't evil until then.
They took it and they turned it into a symbol to use for a very bad reason, whereas those symbols were just all taken from much more ancient cultures.
Interesting. Who were the symbol makers?
Well, it seems like all roads lead back to the Anunnaki. Every time I do this research, and I feel like every time I want to look for influences of other connections somewhere, it just seems to always lead back to this group of the Anunnaki, which I do believe may be a group of potentially beings from many different places, not just
absolutely.
One. It's a term used to blanket the entire group of sort of, you know, think about beings that are not from here, that are ascended beings that are not from here.
Well, I think Sitchin was onto something with his theories, don't you?
Absolutely. He, as I said, Sitchin paved the way for all of this, to understand what kind of influences they had here and how they influenced our story. And I think that our story goes hand in hand with the Anunnaki. In fact, I think we are, in many ways, them. But a version that's much different than it used to be.
There are some experts who do not agree with Zachariah Sitchin. They think his interpretation of the Sumerian tablets are all screwed up and wrong.
I have come to, when I really looked at this and I came to say, I want to know what this story really was. And I want to know if Sitchin was telling the truth.
Right.
What I find that he did make some really, really good points. But there were some areas that I did disagree with. And that was where I began to truly cross-reference and study those tablets to try to see what that story was. And he definitely got us the right direction on that. There was just some minor areas that I disagreed with, just in terms of what the purposes of certain numbers are and certain origin stories and things like that.
I had the honor of giving him a Lifetime Achievement Award at one of the Conscious Life Expo events several years ago before he died, obviously. And he's on stage and I'm giving him the award. And at that time, I didn't know exactly how old he was. He ended up being 90 years old when he died.
Oh, wow.
But I asked him, I said, in front of this crowd, Mr. Sitchin, congratulations, here you are. How old are you? And he turned to the microphone and went, George, that's very rude. But that's the kind of guy he was.
Yeah.
But the work he did investigating the Anunnaki in piecing things together, I thought was absolutely fabulous.
Well, we don't know where we'd be right now with this research if it wasn't for him. I mean,
exactly.
We think about it where some of these experts have come and translated these tablets, but then they get buried in some obscure book somewhere because they're not considered the significance of what they really represent. Because mainstream academia is really handcuffed with how far they can go talking about some of these topics.
In your opinion, what does the Anunnaki represent? Who are they?
They represent the keys to this entire story. How civilizations came out of being nomadic hunter-gatherers. How all of the knowledge of astronomy, mathematics, metallurgy, agriculture, where everything originated from. And it's not just someone's opinion. The Sumerians come out and clearly say that. They state that all of that was handed down from above to them. Not that they discovered it somehow.
How could they make that up if it didn't happen?
Exactly. And how could the Sumerians have detailed accounts of where all the planets are and their ratios without the use of a telescope?
Absolutely. There are some tablets that depict the solar system that they couldn't tell without a telescope. They didn't have that kind of equipment.
That's right.
Somebody told them something.
That cylinder seal is called VA-243, and it depicts an exact representation of our solar system thousands of years before the first telescope was invented.
Yeah, how do you explain this?
To me, it would just be knowledge that had to have been provided to them. Either that or they had some ability to later on view the heavens. We don't really
fully
know.
But where did it go?
Well, that's the mystery.
If they had a telescope, where is it?
That's the point. Just like the tools being gone.
Same thing.
We don't know. But one of the things I will point out is that some of these time periods that I've tried to lay out and some of the timeline work that I've done based on those tablets would put some of the early groups of the Sumerians much, much older than we're told.
If the Anunnaki seeded us, do you think they are the ones who continue to come back, all these UFO reports that we get, and they're just checking up on their farm?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. It's interesting, though, when you look at other texts, you look at ancient Hebrew texts like the Book of Enoch, you look at ancient Vedic texts, the Bhagavad Gita and others, they keep mentioning these groups that watch us, that just watch us from beyond. And the Sumerian tablets, they call them the Ajiji, whereas these other writings, they call them the Watchers. And they seem to be associated with, like you mentioned, some kind of beings that seem to be watching, just observing how things are going here.
How did we do? That's what they're probably thinking.
Yeah, like how is human civilization doing
maybe
now?
Maybe the next experiment will make them a little different.
Yeah, I know. And hopefully there won't be a next experiment, right?
Exactly. We've got another last tablet I want to look at and have you interpret it for us. Let's take a look. What are we looking at here, Matt?
Okay, so this is one of my favorite tablets of all. This is called The Legend of Etana. Now, right there, you get the name legend, which makes
I'm going to let you read this one first.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And it makes it seem like it's a legend, like it's not real, but the more I study this, it goes along with the same comparisons of the same information. So it says, they planned a city. The gods laid its foundations. They planned the city of Kish. The Ajiji founded its brickwork. Let him be there, the people's shepherd. Let Etana be their architect. The great Anunnaki gods, ordainers of destinies, sat taking their counsel concerning the land, the creators of the four world regions, establishers of all physical form.
Now interpret that for us.
This is brilliant to me, George, because what it does is, when we read the other two tablets, the Sumerian king list in Eridu Genesis, it mentioned how Shurupak was the last city before the flood. But this tablet mentions how Kish was the first city created after the flood.
After the flood.
Exactly. And we know that because the Sumerian king list mentions that in a separate set of writings.
Now, I thought the flood wiped out civilizations. So who was the one who would have created this new city?
Well, that's the thing. There were survivors. There were individuals that did survive. And there were certain bloodline kings that carried on those traits like before. And Etana was one of those bloodline kings. And when I read that quote, it wasn't that he just became king because he happened to be powerful and lived there. He was chosen to become king, specifically.
Do they make mention of Noah in anything that you've seen?
Absolutely. Another tablet called the Atrahasis is the original story of what we think of as the biblical story of Noah. But that name was a religious name that was used later. His original name was either Atrahasis, Zayasudra, or Untapishti.
The Anunnaki themselves had a tremendous influence on our past. What about our present?
That's the big question besides when the next cataclysm is going to come, I think. Is that are they still influencing our reality here? Are we still under their control? And it's difficult to understand whether or not when we look at the control systems that exist here, keeping consciousness suppressed and all the different things that happen, whether or not that's just a bunch of powerful elite secret societies or if it is still under the umbrella of the Anunnaki, we don't really know.
If you were speaking before a group of archaeological experts, and you were showing them slides of the Anunnaki and things like that, what would you tell them? What would your theme be?
I would discuss with them how could we have these detailed conversations between them, discussing mankind and wanting to wipe them out and how they felt bad after, if they're simply just this myth and it's symbolic and they're not real. There's so much evidence to prove that there was very, very tangible influences that came from somewhere. Because think about it. Knowledge just can't come from nowhere. It has to come from somewhere.
It's got to originate from something.
Exactly. And so if a lot of the mainstream doesn't want to acknowledge that the Anunnaki are real deities or beings, they just want to act like it's some kind of a force of nature or something like that, connecting to the planets or something like that. But really, I think that they are the keys to the entire story.
I would sit back in the crowd if it were me, and I would raise my hand and go, Mr. LaCroix, were they extraterrestrial? Did they come here?
It definitely seems that they came here from somewhere. But the big question is where? And we find bits and pieces of evidence here and there. There's actually a really neat ancient text that a lot of people aren't familiar with called the Cobram Bible. That was actually an Egyptian and Celtic writing. And it actually talks about, and it mentions that these creators that created this place here for mankind, they came from somewhere far, far away, not of this realm.
Do you think God of the Bible, angels of the Bible, were extraterrestrial?
I think it's all just the same Anunnaki story. I think the angels and demons is just a way to show the different roles that they played. I think it's all the same thing. So
one thing for sure, something absolutely spectacular happened on this planet a long time ago.
Yeah.
And we're still seeking out these answers.
I feel like the rabbit hole is going to just continue to go deeper and deeper, because I want to point out that those tablets that we just read, all of those came from the same ancient library called the Ashurbanipal Library. And when that was uncovered in 1849 by Austin Henry Layard, they found thousands of cuneiform tablets. Thousands. And today, George, less than 200 have been translated by modern academics.
That's astounding.
They're sitting on a dusty back room somewhere.
But they're there somewhere.
They're there somewhere.
They haven't been destroyed, altered, smashed.
Whether or not they're all at the University of Oxford, or some of them are kept down in the Vatican archives, we don't know, because as a society that are seeking these answers, being outside of modern academia, we don't have access to all of these. We just have access to what we're given.
Matt, why is it so important that we get these answers?
Because if you want to know the true story of something, you have to go back to the earliest form of it. When we look at things like the Old and the New Testament, what we find is that it's just being rewritten from previous stories. So I wanted to find answers, and I realized that the only way to find those was to go back to the pure source. And that's what cuneiform writing is. It is the oldest form of writing that exists on the planet. And we know that because anything that would be paper records or anything else that's not in a clay tablet wouldn't have survived till today.
These tablets that were made were done approximately how long after the events that they talk about?
We find that some of the tablets were rewritten from an earlier story and then carried on, but many of those tablets...
hundreds of years? Thousands of years?
Thousands of years. We can trace most of those tablets to well beyond 12,000 years ago.
Wow. That's astounding.
I know to think that a message like that could be preserved, but that's the brilliance behind these cultures.
Do you think the writers of the tablets are just as baffled and were just as baffled as we are today?
I actually think they had a lot more answers than we have today.
What if they made this all up? What if it's just a story, a great book?
Well, that's the thing that I've obviously pondered and wondered myself, because I'm an objective person. But the more you look at what they state, and then you find those ancient ruins of those cities in the locations they mention, it all becomes very real. You know, it's one thing to consider Eridu a myth, but then when you find it in the desert, and
you
then
find
it's being,
something, that's right.
Yeah, and then it's being deliberately hidden and suppressed, you say, aha, so this really is significant.
What do you think Saddam Hussein knew?
Saddam Hussein he was a character that definitely knew about his ancient past in Iraq. And there, I think a later ruler, individual who was like president of Iraq, it came later, was actually mentioned some of those ancient stargates and some of those ancient archaeological sites in Iraq out of being proud. And I think that Saddam did know a lot of great secrets.
He played his cards wrong, though, didn't he?
Well, I mean, look at what happened. Not to justify his actions saying he was a great man or anything, but look at what happened after he was wiped out. Now all those sites are under civil war and we can't even get access to them.
Or destroyed in some cases.
Exactly. Or destroyed. The gates of Nineveh, which is the front gate where the Ashurbanipal Library, the greatest mass of cuneiform tablets in the world, that gate was destroyed by ISIS.
If you could get one major question answered that you've been seeking, what would that be? What would that question be?
I think I would really like to know where the Anunnaki came from, or maybe when they came from.
Uh-huh. What about Sitchin saying they came from this extra planet in our solar system? Well, that you don't seem to be jumping for joy with.
Well, the thing is, though, even if I don't necessarily agree with them coming from there, there definitely is another planet that exists out beyond
it's out there somewhere.
Oh, there is definitely a planet. That's one of the areas that I've done quite a bit of research too, that things like the Pioneer 10 probe and others have found. There are secrets beyond our inner solar system that are very, very interesting.
I mean, for Sitchin to make this, and we go back to him again, to make this incredible assertion that the Anunnaki came from this extra planet is remarkable. But he claims he interpreted that from the Sumerian tablets.
It does mention it. It calls it Nibiru. And the way you want to translate it, it's you can either consider it some kind of a planet or some kind of a temple. We don't fully know. A lot of those, one of the most important things to bring up is that Sumerian is a dead language. Sumerian cuneiform died out thousands of years ago. And so when Austin Henry Layard first uncovered those tablets, it took over 20 years before the first person, George Smith, in 1875, actually could translate the first one. It was a dead language for thousands of years.
This interpretation, is it just Sitchin's, or is he backed up by these?
Yeah, that was what I really wanted to know. I wanted to actually understand who the best translators in the world was. Because Sitchin was good at understanding and interpreting things, but he wasn't an expert Assyriologist. George Smith, who I mentioned, was the first one to actually translate a cuneiform tablet. And he had studied ancient Assyrian cultures for years and years and years. And it took over 20 years, but he finally, in 1875, he translated the first tablet ever in human, well, in our human history, I should say, in the last 5,000 exactly. years. And he translated, the Epic of Gilgamesh was the first tablet to ever be translated.
You've got a passion for this, Matt. What drives you?
I love ancient mysteries. I have this deep connection to our past being much more complex than we've been told. And that journey of discovering that truth has been the core of my drive to do this.
What's your next project?
Actually, right now I'm co-writing my third book with Billy Carson, where we're calling it The Epic of Humanity, because using tablets and everything from Vedic text to cuneiform text to ancient Hebrew text to Aztec and Maya text, we want to understand what's the story of our story from what they say and what the evidence says, not what modern academia says.
Matt, thanks for being on Beyond Belief.
Thank you so much, George. It was a pleasure.
It's one of the greatest mysteries of humankind. What happened to the Anunnaki? Where did they go? Where are their tools? Where are the artifacts? Will we ever know? Maybe one day. I'm George Norrie. Thanks for watching Beyond Belief.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gaia's Unexplained Podcast. To learn even more, go to Gaia.com, where you can watch interviews, movies, and original series. Gaia.com, content you can't find anywhere else. For more information, visit GaiaUnexplained.com.